Do not fold, bend, staple, or mutilate this card. The slogan of the computer age. The University of Illinois Radio Service presents a series of programs about you and the computer. From banks to hospitals, and from airlines to music, its applications seem endless. These programs will give you a glimpse of these countless applications and what they mean to you. Do Not Fold begins the story of the modern computer in early history. For centuries, man has added and subtracted. He has counted the days in a year and the sheep in his herd. At first, man used his fingers. The 10 fingers of a human created a decimal basis for his counting system. When trade grew and numbers frequently reached higher than 10, the hand was slow. So the abacus was developed. The clacking of the beads in each row as tens were carried into hundreds signaled the start of a new generation of adding tools used by man.
In 1642, the son of a grocer devised a machine that used gears and would add together numbers on a decimal basis. Blaise Pascal had invented the forerunner of today's digital computer. The real father of the computer, however, was Charles Babbage. In 1812, Mr. Babbage planned a complex adding machine dependent upon automatic parts. Despite financial aid from the British government, he never finished the project. The technology of the times was not yet ready for his ideas. Mechanical parts were too slow for his calculating engine. Babbage needed electronic components not yet invented.
The United States Bureau of the Census provided the next impetus for the development of today's digital computer. The law of the land had provided that the federal government must count the people every 10th year. As the nation grew, so did the problems of conducting this census. More doors had to be opened by more citizens in more communities.
Good afternoon, ma'am. I'm a representative of the United States Census Bureau, and I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Oh, yes?
Yes. First of all, we'd like to know how many people reside in this house.
Well, there's my husband and myself and our 6 children, and my Aunt Steffi, and my sister Josie and my father-in-law. Oh, and Cousin George and Herb's twin sisters from Detroit.
That census taker had no easy task, but Dr. Herman Hollerith hoped to improve the situation. In 1890, he conceived the idea of putting information on punched cards. This would speed tabulation of information on a special machine and would allow rapid computation of results.
The tense years of World War II created a special interest in the capabilities of a computing machine. The advanced technology of 1940 allowed men much more freedom than Charles Babbage had known in 1812, over 100 years earlier. While Churchill urged courage and Hitler planned invasions, men at Harvard University, International Business Machines, and Bell Laboratories joined forces to construct the Mark I. Slow electromechanical relays were the main components of this computer. These cumbersome devices took up to 5 seconds to do multiplication. When electron tubes were added to the hardware of the newly developed computers, results were more efficient. ENIAC, or the Electronic Numerical Integrator and Calculator, was designed to compute trajectory tables for firing shells. Experts in ballistics had used complex calculations to determine where a shell might land if of a certain size, fired at a certain angle, from a certain location.
Vacuum tubes were not foolproof, however. Their rate of failure was high, and yet each of 18,000 tubes had to be operative or the system would not work. In 1946, ENIAC blew out several hundreds of its vacuum tubes during a futile attempt to divide by zero because no one had remembered to instruct the computer that the task was impossible. In 1949, the University of Illinois built a special computer labeled the Iliac 1 for the Aberdeen Proving Grounds. When the university built a second, just like the first, for its own use, it became the first mass producer of computers. The most important advance in technology for the computer was yet to come. In 1948, J. Bardeen, N. F. Mott, and W. Schottky at Bell Laboratories invented the transistor, an electronic component that would replace the vacuum tube in the modern computer. New materials at hand after the war made possible this startling development.
Now that wires were connected and transistors soldered in, the computer spewed out information. Where was this information coming from? How did the computer handle it? What does a computer look like? Today's large computer is cased in steel cabinets, which may be as small as a file cabinet. Inside the doors on these cabinets are three main portions of the computer. The memory area stores information for later use by the computer and is the repository for all incoming information. The central processor takes this data stored in the memory and operates on it according to the instructions provided. The input-output area of the computer readies data for the actual calculations involved and then returns this data in the proper form. Let's trace the path of that data through the modern digital computer. When a problem is being prepared for today's computer, it must first be put into the proper form. The machine does not understand human language without translation.
The digital computer typically operates on the basis of numbers, but only two. For example, in the memory, a vast system of crossed wires creates thousands of points within the web. At the juncture of two wires, a ferrite core can be magnetized either in a positive or negative direction. This point could represent either the number 1 or the number 0. The term bit is a contraction of the words binary digit and implies information stored on one of these cores in the memory. Binary refers to a two-number system, and the word digit is derived from the Latin word digitus, or finger, man's first counting device. The idea of counting with only two fingers or two digits may seem impossibly difficult to a person familiar with 10 numbers, but Roger Johnson, research assistant at the Coordinated Science Laboratory at the University of Illinois, explains how it actually works.
Let us consider the problem of counting and performing arithmetic in a number system which consists of only two symbols or numbers. For example, let us use the two symbols 0 and 1. Any number in this system, therefore, must consist of some combination of ones and zeros. The three-digit binary number 100 is an example. In the decimal number system, the digit positions of a number from right to left are given the values ones place, tens place, hundreds place, etc. The number 52, or 52, is thought of as representing two ones and five tens. In the binary number system, the digit positions from right to left are given the values ones place, twos place, the fours place, eights place, etc. The values of these digit positions are obtained by counting the number of different possible combinations of arranging the symbols 1 and 0. Therefore, the binary number 100 can be thought of as no ones, no twos, and 1 4. Thus, the binary number 100 is equivalent to the decimal number 4. In this binary system, the numbers 0 and 1 have the same meaning as in the decimal system. The decimal number 2 is represented by the two-digit binary number 10, which can be thought of as no ones and 1 2. The decimal number 3 is represented by the two-digit binary number 11. That is, a 1 in the ones place and a 1 in the twos place. Since we have now used up all of the combinations of two-digit binary numbers, the decimal number 4 must be represented by the three-digit binary number 100, or no ones, no twos, and 1 4. One can easily continue in a similar manner to describe all of the decimal numbers in terms of the equivalent binary numbers.
Since a given combination of these binary digits can represent a letter or number, data can be fed into the computer in more complex forms. The programmer, or person who sets up the series of instructions for the computer, can use this basic computer language, often called machine language, or rely on other languages more similar to English. With such a language as Fortran, for example, a programmer might construct a program to process your gasoline credit card. Roger Johnson, of the Coordinated Science Laboratory at the University of Illinois, explains how this might be set up.
In a program of this type, cards containing instructions would be read into the machine. Then these instructions would be carried out by the computer. The first instruction might read as follows. Read card, comma, 100, comma, ID, comma, amount, comma, date, comma, IDS. This statement causes the computer to read a punch card according to certain rules and to place the data on this card into specific memory locations in the computer. For example, the purchaser's identification number is placed into the memory location labeled ID. The amount of the purchase is placed into a memory location labeled amount. The date is placed into a memory location labeled date, and the distributor's identification number is placed into a memory location labeled IDS. The second computer statement might read, AMT equals balance parentheses ID. This statement causes the computer to take the customer's account balance, which is stored in the memory location balance ID, and places it into another location labeled AMT. The next statement would read, AMT equals AMT plus amount. This statement adds the amount of the previous balance to the amount of the purchase and stores this sum in the memory location labeled AMT. The next computer statement might read, balance parentheses ID equals AMT. This statement causes the computer to place the new balance stored in AMT into the memory location labeled balance parentheses ID. Thus, the customer's account has now been updated. Using similar statements, the program would credit the proper distributor with a sale and then read the next card.
New languages are constantly being developed with different capabilities and characteristics. We asked Dr. Stephen Fenves, professor of civil engineering at the University of Illinois, to comment on the need for these new languages.
Initially, when computers first became available, each computer had its own set of instructions, and the only thing the programmer could do was to write down the individual instructions to that particular machine. This was a time-consuming activity, and also there was no choice as to what kind of language the person could use. Then in the early 50s, some people began to recognize that communication could be raised at a different level, that the person could state larger chunks of computation, which to him meant a unit of processing, and let the computer convert these into the individual instructions. This obviously was a great improvement in communication, and furthermore, it had the advantage that one could write programs for different machines, essentially machine-independent programs, as long as the different computers had a translating program called a compiler, which could interpret these statements and translate them into machine instructions. You really didn't care what machine you used. I think this kind of trend is coming to an end. The government, all the large users are very concerned about this proliferation. Now we have standard Fortran and standard COBOL, which are government standards like any other standards. And most of the languages are veering towards a greater generality, picking up the better parts of everything and then incorporating them in one package.
Once the data has been couched in a particular language, how does it get into the computer? At first, programmers used punch cards. These cards, which are still in common use, contain 80 vertical columns with 10 rows each. Each column represents a character. Thus, the first row in column 1 punched would mean number 1, and the fifth row in column 2 punched would mean number 5. The holes in each card allow current to pass through the card only at that point. An electrically charged roller is on one side of the punched card, and a metallic brush is on the other side. The cards act as insulators between the roller and the brush, so that an electrical impulse only flows through the holes.
Why do these cards that we encounter every day have the constant reminder, do not fold, bend, staple, or mutilate this card? Any alteration of the physical characteristics of this card may affect the reading of the card. An electrical impulse may flow through a torn hole or a staple and render the information on the card totally inaccurate. A bank account may be credited or debited by $1,000 because of a pinprick in the wrong column. A card may fail to run through the reading device and have to be repunched, creating further possibilities of error. So the warning, do not fold, is an important danger sign of the computer age. This is the sound of punched holes on a paper tape, read in a special reading device. However, a much more effective input mechanism is magnetic tape or magnetic disc. A punch card reader may average 250 cards a minute or 20,000 characters a minute. Magnetic tape can feed in tens of thousands of characters per second. Even the typewriter can be used to input information. Typewriters are much slower, but more familiar to the average person who might want to use a computer. Instructions for the computer can be typed on special typewriters step by step.
Typewriters can also be connected to special terminals with television tubes. Information typed into the computer may appear on the screen of the cathode ray tube, and then data calculated by the computer may be presented on this tube. Even drawings may be sketched on the tube with a special light pen. A recent development in visual displays may prove even more versatile than the cathode ray tube. Engineers at the University of Illinois have devised a plasma display panel less than a quarter inch thick, which has thousands of crossing wires invisible to the naked eye. Each point on this panel may be lighted or unlighted, producing an image in black and white or color. Dr. Donald Bitzer, one of the inventors of the plasma display panel, explains why this device may compare favorably with a cathode ray tube for computer work.
It has the ability to retain its own image, and this is one of its important aspects. Consequently, once you turn a little spot on the screen, it stays on without the computer telling it to go on each 30 times every second. Or you can turn the spot off, and you do not disturb any of the neighboring spots. Another important aspect of the screen is that it's transparent, and we want to be able to superimpose pictures along with the computer-generated graphics. This allows us to do it. We can project on the back of the same screen, and the student can now view this projection through the screen, any pictures. So the student can see the computer-generated graphics along with the picture graphics now, which can be much higher quality than a television picture, right on the same screen, in a very economical and useful way. Some of the other aspects which we think are important but not absolutely essential are that we can produce these things in different colors, and so we're able to have a high quality graphic color presentation as well as a monochromatic presentation. Also very important, of course, is that our screen responds directly to digital computer signals. It need not go through conversion devices, such as cathode ray tube devices have to go through, in order to produce the image. And so the computer can write or turn on a spot on the screen accurately, with complete reliability, complete accuracy, without having to worry about high-quality electronic circuits which may get out of adjustment as time goes on, thus making the terminal more reliable for computer home use, for a computer application. And then, of course, the last, but certainly not the least important aspect, is that for computer applications, we can probably produce this device at a fraction of the cost necessary to produce equipment to do the same job by any other method.
The next step in communication with the computer may be human speech. Engineers are studying this problem in hopes that a computer can be instructed to understand the sounds of the human voice. Human brains can understand these patterns, and so why not the computer? You know that many different pronunciations of the same word mean the same thing, but the computer cannot be stored with these millions of variables in human speech patterns. As a matter of fact, scientists suggest that a person's voice may be as distinct as his fingerprint, unlike any others. Still, the Autonetics Corporation has devised a simple system to recognize sound. As a man says the word slow into a microphone, a typewriter linked to the computer prints out S-L-O-W. Its vocabulary is limited to 100 words at the moment.
Though computers may have difficulty understanding human speech, it is easy for them to speak in a sense. They may activate recorded messages on any topic. The last time you dialed an incorrect number, you heard a message activated by a computer.
I'm sorry, we are unable to complete your call as dialed. Please check the number and dial again or ask your operator for assistance. This is a recording.
Some research also shows that a computer may learn to speak itself. Men at Bell Laboratories in Murray Hill, New Jersey, have given the computer information about the function of the human speech organs. At the outset, the computer speaks slowly, as it does hundreds of calculations to determine how particular sounds are formed. After it has decided the basic elements of the sound pattern, it speaks quickly.
He saw the cat.
Without the phrasing of human speech, the sentence sounds flat. With timing, the computer sounds better.
He saw the cat.
Still, pitch is missing.
He saw the cat.
Scientists have even programmed computers to sing popular melodies and provide musical accompaniment.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. A stylish marriage, I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
The primary vehicle for all information put into the computer is the program. Within the confines of these specialized instructions, the computer can manipulate figures and data and provide answers. Actual problems put into the form of computer programs take hours of preparation. One reason for using a computer is to avoid excessively complex calculations by hand. Still, the logic of these calculations must be conveyed to the computer so that it will know how to handle incoming data. The many revisions of a computer program are labeled debugging. Some suggest that this title may have originated with Dr. Grace Hopper, a pioneer programmer who told of a lengthy testing session at the Harvard Computation Lab in which an apparently erroneous program was checked and rechecked. Finally, someone located a fly stuck in one of the relays, preventing electrical contact. So insects may cause just as much trouble to computers as they do to human beings.
Now that the computer has been put together and information has been fed into the memory via punch cards or magnetic tapes, the computer goes to work. The thousands of points within the memory of the computer that are either one or zero are compared with, added to, or subtracted from each other. The end results of such electrical mathematics are printed on a high-speed printer that can put out up to 1,000 lines of type a minute. Calculations that might have taken days may be available in a few minutes because of today's computer.
The language of the computer contains many unfamiliar terms. Some we've considered already. A bit is a binary digit or part of a two-number system. A memory is a vast system of crossed wires that are electrically magnetized. A program is a set of instructions for the computer. But what about batch programming, real-time, and online systems? Let's take one at a time.
Problems can be gathered and solved all at the same time using the same program. Companies may do all their calculations of the monthly payroll on one day instead of updating information in the memory as an employee works another hour each day. Batch programming is done when all the necessary information is at hand, perhaps several hours, days, or even years after the data was originally collected. Other computers, however, are online and work in real time. Information is not gathered but fed directly into the computer as it is accumulated. The input device is hooked directly to the computer or online. Some banks have installed terminals at every teller's window, and as deposits are made, the customer's account is immediately credited. New data constantly updates files in the memory of the computer.
Well, that seems clear, but what about the term multiprogramming?
Sometimes a computer has more capabilities than those in use at a particular time. It is possible for others to use those free capabilities and solve their own problems at the same time. Although it appears that the computer is serving everyone at the same time, actually it is sharing its time in millisecond doses with everyone. Each user is delayed a small fraction of a second while the computer handles input and calculations in turn. Few notice this delay because it is measured in such small portions of a second.
We've been describing the modern digital computer, which handles the largest part of the load of electronic data processing today. Another kind of computer, the analog computer, is also used to solve special problems, primarily in engineering. A digital computer operates on the basis of two numbers which are indicated by the positive or negative direction of magnetization. An analog computer deals in voltages. Voltages may range across a wide scale and indicate changes in measurement. However, voltage readings may tend to be slightly inaccurate, and therefore digital computers are preferred for most modern applications. In later programs in this series, we'll learn where analog computers play an important role in electronic data processing.
We'll also examine the applications of digital computers in industry, finance, government, medicine, and other areas. Major companies across the United States are continuing to develop computers with new capabilities for the demands of today. Competition among such firms as International Business Machines, Control Data Corporation, Scientific Data Systems, Sperry Rand, and Burroughs has produced ever larger and more complex installations of computers. Public and private agencies have cooperated in the development of computers over the last three decades, from the earliest ENIAC to the latest third-generation equipment.
Today, we follow the development of the computer from Babbage's marvelous machine to the present-day digital computer. In upcoming programs in this series, we'll see how computers can be used to tabulate sorority rush, arrange dates, fly airplanes, bake cakes, and write music. On our next program, we'll discover how the future may bring a war without men. Each week, the University of Illinois Radio Service brings you the meaning behind the slogan of the computer age, "Do not fold, bend, staple, or mutilate this card." This program was distributed by the National Educational Radio Network.